This is The City Will Rise, exploring the aftermath of disasters from San Francisco to New York to New Orleans. I'm Mary Alice Williams. Three quarters of San Francisco was destroyed, some by the earthquake, some by dynamite, most by fire. But within hours of the quake, while flames were spreading throughout the city, another San Francisco was already being created. Here again is Philip Fradkin.
The people who set about reorganizing and directing the future of San Francisco were those people who had an economic interest in the results. They were land developers, they were bankers, they were, in some cases, politicians or close to politicians, people who owned the municipal railways, who constituted what I call this elite oligarchy.
On the afternoon of April 18th, these men, led by former Mayor James D. Phelan, formed what they called the Committee of 50 to manage the relief effort, recovery, and rebuilding of San Francisco.
They didn't know what they were going to do, but what they did instantaneously, and therefore someone who acts quickly in a vacuum has a good chance of acquiring power. So that very first day, they held a meeting at the Hall of Justice. The Hall of Justice was about to go up in the flames, and they escaped. They went up the hill to the brand new Fairmont Hotel. They held a short meeting there, and they're going to meet there again on the 19th. Well, by the 19th, the fire had consumed the Fairmont Hotel. So they went further west, I think, to Fillmore Street and established a headquarters. And they subdivided, like amoeba, into various committees.
There was a finance committee, headed by James Phelan himself, that managed the flow of money into the city. There was a press committee, made up of owners and editors of San Francisco's newspapers, that managed the flow of information out of the city.
What they did was issue bulletins through this press committee, which consisted of the press, and that was the news that went out to the world. That was carefully controlled. In fact, at one time when donations were lagging, they manufactured a rainstorm falling on the refugees, which ostensibly would cause pity to rise in the hearts of other Americans and more donations to flow into their coffers.
First America, then the world, opened hearts and purses to San Francisco. Donations poured in. Initially, there was uncertainty about insurance money. Throughout the city, it was nearly impossible to tell whether destruction was caused by earthquake, fire, or dynamite. But inspiration came from London.
There was a lot of concern in 1906 of policyholders from many different insurers not getting paid, and that the magnitude of the disaster was such that the insurers just gave up.
Lord Peter Levine is chairman of Lloyd's.
This was not the case with Lloyd's, and the then chairman, Cuthbert Heath, just issued an instruction from London, pay all our policyholders. They felt an obligation to meet the requirements that had been put on them and for which they'd been paid.
Following Lloyd's lead, most insurers paid their claims, although to varying degrees. Freight cars began arriving, filled with food, clothing, and building materials. Speeches were made across the country. Periodicals were flooded with articles about heroic San Francisco.
Supreme Pacific One.
Songs, some of them rather disastrous themselves, were inspired by the city's plight.
The world bemoans your fate.
One of the committees, spawned by the Committee of 50, was devoted to the relocation of Chinatown, which lay in ruins after the earthquake and fire.
I was 7 years old when the earthquake came.
Alice Su Fun lived in Chinatown in 1906. More than 70 years later, she told her story in an interview with historian Judy Young, author of the book Unbound Voices.
In the morning, I remember, you know, how everything fell off the shelf. You know, just everything just fell off the shelf. And we had one of those stoves made out of brick, you know, my father cooked. And the stove has crumbled. So my father was very worried about the stove, and he was going to put it back again. But very soon, then we had to leave the place. We had to evacuate. See? There were soldiers all over.
You mean they just guns. Came and tell you to get out and go to the park and stay there?
Yes, because they wouldn't let anybody stay in the building. Everybody had to leave the building. I had one sister and two brothers at the time of the earthquake. And my mother was pregnant. Oh, it was hard then. After 3 days, we came over to Oakland. And then I remember we went live in a tent by Lake Merritt. And then my father digged clams, and we ate the clams from the Lake Merritt, you know. But he got sick eating the clam. He died from the typhoid fever, contaminated water. He died before my sister was born. My sister was born 4 days after my father died.
The city at large really didn't care to take any note of, you know, how many Chinese were dead. And as far as they're concerned, it'd be great if they were all wiped out.
Philip Choi is a San Francisco architect and Chinese-American historian.
That, to me, was the sentiment of the city. And that gives you the answer why you don't find much statistics and very much information about the Chinese. From the time that the Chinese first came, the city was trying to get rid of the Chinese, passing all kinds of ordinances to harass the Chinese. And so when the earthquake came, it was almost like God sent, and God have answered our prayers. We can get rid of the Chinese now.
The big fire has obliterated Chinatown from San Francisco forever. Mayor Schmitz informed Chief of Police Dinan that all of the Chinese now in the city would be collected and placed in Fontana's warehouses near Fort Mason, and that the new Chinatown would be located at Hunter's Point on the southern extremity of the county on the Bay Shore. All Chinese who have left the city and who return late will be concentrated at the new points. San Francisco Chronicle, April 25th, 1906.
Editorials supporting the removal of the Chinese from San Francisco appeared in newspapers across the country, but the committee's efforts met with considerable resistance on other fronts. Once again, Philip Fradkin.
The effort to get the Chinese out of Chinatown drew the wrath of the Chinese government at the time, but was more effectively carried out by the economic clout of the Chinese at the scene. The Chinese, being very smart, intelligent people, and knowing where the power lay, invited representatives of Seattle and Portland to come down, made that fact known, and said they were perfectly willing to move to those other Western cities where they knew they would be welcome and where, in fact, their considerable economic clout was desired. Well, it didn't take long for the people in San Francisco to decide that they wanted the Chinese back because they did represent an extensive amount of commercial opportunity. Secondly, as it turns out, most of the real estate in Chinatown was owned by white landlords who wanted to, again, erect buildings and lease and or rent to the Chinese.
So Chinatown rose again right where it had been. But the new Chinatown had a different look. It became what historian Philip Choi calls a kind of theme park.
Even the merchants, just prior to the earthquake, already had this idea of rebuilding Chinatown into what I call, quote-unquote, an Oriental Mecca. And the idea was you can come to San Francisco and see the Orient. You don't have to go to China. Look how much money you can save. That kind of propaganda. The skyline that you see today was a decided effort to redesign Chinatown to bring its true culture, quote unquote, to the mainstream.
Enrico Caruso, traumatized by the earthquake, vowed never to return to San Francisco. He kept his word. "I'll take Vesuvius," he famously said. San Francisco's movers and shakers made vows of their own. "There is no reason to doubt," wrote James Phelan, "that within a few years a newer and better built city will rise upon the ruins of the old." He was right, in part. In a few years, upon the ruins of the old San Francisco, the city did rise. Here again is historian Kevin Starr.
I think outside the effect the earthquake had to encourage a number of leading geologists to take a close and sustained look at the geological factors leading to earthquakes, I think other than that, in terms of the San Francisco of politicians and business people and residents here, etc., I think they erased it. They substituted the rebuilding of the city as the conquest of the earthquake, i.e. the city has been rebuilt. That's the moral equivalent of victory.
Gold in peace and iron in war is written upon the seal of the city. Happiness and abundance in the piping days of peace. Fortitude and courage in the trying days of war. And war we have had against the forces of nature and the destructive fury of the elements. But through it all, our people have risen better and stronger. Their cheerfulness in distress and undaunted courage in the presence of danger have excited the admiration of the world. James D. Phelan in the Overland Monthly, August 1906.
President William Howard Taft visited San Francisco in the fall of 1911, breaking ground for the Panama Pacific International Exposition that would open a few years later. In a speech, Taft saluted San Francisco as the city that knows how. The phrase came to stand for the city's triumph over disaster. Looking at it from 100 years out, what did San Francisco know? Robert Hartwig is chief economist for the Insurance Information Institute in New York.
In 1906, many of the structures that burned simply didn't need to have burned down. We wound up with political and military control of entities that really shouldn't have been controlling the fire department. Consequently, communications were very difficult, relations were strained, and we could see actually that these same sort of organizational problems that plagued the response to the 1906 earthquake and contributed tremendously to an enormous loss of value in terms of the number of buildings and even loss of life. These same factors tend to recur over time. And in fact, we saw similar sense of disorganization in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
Mardi Gras, 2006. It's a warm, sunny morning in New Orleans. Poet and writer James Nolan grew up with this celebration.
Carnival in Latin means goodbye to the flesh. So it's a celebration of the flesh before the 40-day Lenten season to prepare for Easter, which is the resurrection of the flesh. So it all has a kind of theological fabric to it. Of course, it's been sold to the world as a sort of blowout street party just on Tuesday, on Mardi Gras Day, and people forget that it really begins on the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th. And it's not really a celebration of how wonderful life is, but it's a celebration of not of our good luck, but we're celebrating in spite of our bad luck. So this year we have a lot to celebrate.
My name is Alain Simard, and I've lived here in the French Quarter since 1972. People are discouraged, you know, because of the slow response to what's happening to, you know, the government is just so busy pointing fingers right now. And unfortunately, you know, we need help, some kind of direction, I think. Somebody needs to step up and say, you know, this is how we should proceed in rebuilding this beautiful, you know, incredible city, this magical place. But, you know, the soul of the city is hurt and broken. And I'm so proud of this city that, you know, I feel this pain, I feel this hurt.
This year, the celebrants share the streets with ruins from the flood. heaps of discarded furniture, sheetrock, broken toys. There aren't as many floats, and the parades are mostly limited to a single route, because there aren't enough police and cleanup crews to handle more. There aren't as many tourists either. It makes for a different kind of festival, which for many residents is a good thing.
I know a lot of people who aren't here who just didn't want to this year, you know, but I'm loving this. It's just really nice, you know.
Here in the French Quarter, which we call the Isle of Denial, it feels quite normal to me.
Again, James Nolan.
But of course, driving around the other parts of the city that I grew up in, that are just flooded wastelands that people haven't returned to, only about a third of the population has returned at this point. And again, because of the forced evacuation, people had to leave the city for 6 weeks, and they had to put their children in schools, they got other jobs, they even bought houses elsewhere. And so a lot of people are reluctant to return. They're particularly reluctant to return because they've lost all faith in the authorities in this city.
I trusted in them, and I thought they're going to help us in our home, they're going to help bring this back to the way it was or should be.
This is Bree Matsuoka, who was at Ground Zero on 9/11 in New York City.
I trusted the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, and I was so disappointed. And I trusted the city, and then what I found was they were getting caught up in all kinds of politics and political wars, from money to memories and how the memories were going to be acknowledged, and things became so, so ugly.
The problem that we see is that government agencies that have a responsibility for protecting public health, in fact, played the role of dismissing the hazards that the public was potentially exposed to.
Dr. Stephen Levin is head of the Data and Coordination Center for the World Trade Center Medical Monitoring Program at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
The head of the EPA, within 1 week of the 9/11 events themselves, was on television saying, "We're happy to be able to tell you that the air quality is safe." Now, at that point, monitoring hadn't been done to even address the questions that really had to be answered before one could make such a statement. We have since learned from looking at the EPA's Inspector General's report that the White House Council on Environmental Quality directly influenced what the EPA had to say about air quality in Lower Manhattan after the 9/11 event, that they essentially said to the EPA, "Don't issue cautionary words, reassure people that everything is all right." And this had quite clearly a political and economic motive to it. And one can argue about whether those motives were, you know, reasonable motives, but it had a definite public health consequence. I have patients with asthma among office workers who returned to Lower Manhattan within a week and a half of the 9/11 events, because their employers said, "If you don't come back to work, you lose your job," who never had asthma before, who never had significant sinusitis before, who now suffer from severe sinusitis or asthma. And it's the consequence of government pronouncements about the safety of the environment.
Test results came out from the EPA that said that the air quality was fine and we had nothing to worry about. And then the parents met afterwards and saying, "You know, are you sure it's okay for the children? You said the air quality is fine for, you know, the public, but does that include children?" So then we had results again that came out that said, "Yes, it's fine for the children." And during this time, my child started developing a cough. And we went to the doctor and found out that it might be asthma. So we had an inhaler for her, which I hated to do, but she was coughing and, you know, it was affecting her sleeping at night, and we were quite worried. But we trusted that the air quality was fine, so I assumed it was possibly genetic or from some other way that she got asthma. Well, we decided to leave a year later. We wanted to stay in the community. We wanted to stay because we wanted to be a support with our neighbors. But after a year of looking out my window and seeing a deep, dark hole and things not getting anywhere, and I was having panic attacks, I was having terrible dreams and not trusting in the system anymore, I wanted to get away. So we left after a year and we moved
way to the other side of Manhattan. And my daughter's coughing stopped. No more. We got up there, and within a few days, she stopped coughing.
I think what really embitters and damages people, and I see this in the Katrina people I talk to, is not so much the initial trauma, but the racism, the callousness, the class interests, the opportunism that arises in the wake of the disaster.
San Francisco writer Rebecca Solnit is the author of The Uses of Disaster and other works on the aftermath of catastrophes. Besides bitterness and contention, she says another product of disasters is accelerated change.
Often what arises is new organizations, new political forces, new senses of community. The Chinese word for emergency is made up of the characters for danger and opportunity. And, you know, and there is a real opportunity to rethink things and remake things.
In New York, Dr. Stephen Levin at Mount Sinai wants to rethink and remake the way the city responds to 9/11-type emergencies.
You've got to immediately after such a disaster set up a panel of experts, and preferably they set up in advance, who are knowledgeable about environmental exposures and the potential health consequences of such exposures, including the psychological consequences. And that group of experts has to be isolated from political and economic influences in their assessment of what's going on and what should be done for people, how to protect them. Some grouping of people who are knowledgeable and experienced has to be isolated from the politicians and those who have desire to see economic, you know, enterprises rolling again, so that they can really assess in isolation what are the hazards and what had we better do from a public health point of view.
At the Insurance Information Institute, Robert Hartwig wants to rethink how we pay for disasters.
What needs to be changed is the incentives to local developers, to people who choose to live in disaster-prone areas. It must be made known to them that they are going to have to bear the costs associated with that. It is very difficult to ask people in North Dakota or people in Ohio to perennially pay for hurricane damage in the coastal parts of the United States. It is very difficult, even within a state like Florida, to ask retired grandmothers living on a fixed income in Gainesville, an interior city, to subsidize damage to millionaires' homes on a barrier island near Key West. This is a very difficult proposition, but that's actually what happens today. Everyone, for example, in the state of Florida in 2006 will get an assessment on their homeowner's insurance policy of roughly 11%. No matter where they live, no matter who their insurance company is, no matter whether they've ever filed a claim. And this is going to make up for a loss in the state-run insurance company. And people are starting to get very upset about that. And that's because they perceive the fact that people who live in the coastal areas are more at risk and they should bear that risk themselves.
In New Orleans, Richard Campanella wants to rethink the way the city works. He's a geographer, author, and assistant director of the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane University.
We have lots of cities, historic, important cities worth holding on to, that were founded under conditions when humans depended heavily on waterborne transportation. And now we have situations of eroding coasts and subsiding seaports and rising sea. And so New Orleans is one of the cities on the front lines of that dilemma. But I suspect it's going to be a common dilemma worldwide in the 21st century, of old historic coastal cities having increasing numbers of geographical and environmental problems. So, you know, we should view New Orleans as an opportunity to start honing those skills to protect these areas. And it's doable. Not 300 feet from where we're sitting right now, we have 500,000 cubic feet per second of fresh water with a sediment load that could be used to build up these coastal wetlands and build up a buffer. We have less sediment than we had 100 years ago because of all the dams that we've built, but we have to mine sediment from the bottom of the river here and divert it out onto the back swamp and build up that wetlands buffer, which has disappeared. You could think of wetlands as being, you know, speed bumps for incoming storm surges. Roughly for every 2 to 3 miles of wetlands that you have there, 1 vertical foot of storm surge is absorbed. So, yes, we need Category 5 levees, but we also need outer tiers of defense. And again, it's not going to be just New Orleans. It's other cities as well.
I think only music will save this city. I think music is its identifier.
Folklorist Nick Spitzer hosts the radio program American Roots in New Orleans.
Music is the thing that made New Orleans famous to the world. Music is how people have always entertained themselves in these neighborhoods, not to make a big living at it historically anyway, more to just entertain. And jazz almost was a folk music at one point. It was played by cigar rollers and plasterers and plumbers and carpenters. And there still is that aspect to local jazz and R&B and soul and funk. On the other side, music's a big public identity to the world. And so without it, the world doesn't come here. Without it, people don't feel like they're part of something here with continuity. So I say we really need the music, and I almost feel like the infrastructure will follow if the people want to be here for the music and the culture that it represents.
Years later, what can we take away from San Francisco in 1906? What can the city that knows how pass on to New York and New Orleans? We close with these observations from James Haas and Rebecca Solnit.
A conflicted city is not a very good place to solve problems. We are as conflicted today as we were in 1906. The city still has major public buildings that are not seismically stable. There's a whole lot of work to do. And it would be great if we could use the 1906 experience to show people how a dysfunctional city is not a way to solve problems.
I think the best thing is to look at how do we strengthen civil society, how do we strengthen people's sense that they may be adequate to the occasion, that they may be adequate to make a better city, a better community after a disaster, that they are enormously powerful. You know, they're immensely vulnerable, but also immensely valuable. It's one thing you learn often in these disasters.
The City Will Rise featured the voice talents of Blair Hardman, Steve Jackson, Laura Simpson, Doug Hudgens, and Ray C. Wright. Field recording by Michael Jones. Studio recording by Leszek Wojcik at Carnegie Hall Recording Studio. The program was mastered by Robin Wise at Sound Imagery in Sebastopol, California. Special thanks to Nick Spitzer and the staff at American Roots in New Orleans. Marketing and distribution by Creative PR in Los Angeles. The executive producers are Sarah Frank and Jonathan Marder at General Strategic Marketing in New York. The City Will Rise was written, produced, and directed by Jesse Boggs. I'm Mary Alice Williams. For more information on The City Will Rise and the topics covered here, log on to www.thecitywillrise.info.
Les élèves ont enroulé.